Stuart Eldon is currently a professor in the Department of Geography at Durham University in the UK, having received his doctorate in political theory from Brunel University in 1999. Though this double disciplinary profile, geography and political theory, certainly points us in the right direction for understanding Professor Eldon's work, it seems to me that Stuart Eldon is not quite a geographer or a political theorist, nor even some congenial hybrid of the two. He is rather a philosophical researcher in the tradition exemplified by Michel Foucault. The question of space, which perhaps uniquely solicits such an approach, has been the guiding thread of his ongoing project. I choose the appellation of philosophical researcher carefully. Unlike so many who have followed in Foucault's footsteps, Stuart Eldon has shortchanged neither philosophy nor research. On the contrary, he has sustained a most stringent philosophical reading practice and labor of the concept without ever succumbing to philosophical arrogance or aloofness, and he has raided the archives without ever succumbing to archive fever. A brief survey of his works is instructive. Partisans of anachrony would do well to read his first book, Mapping the Present, Heidegger, Foucault, and the Project of Spatial History from 2001. Eldon's subsequent work on the concept of rhythm analysis, including his translation of Henri Lefebvre's late work on this topic and his own 2004 monograph, Understanding Henri Lefebvre, gives yet further filigree to this historical-political crisscrossing of space and time. Students of poetics and theory may find speaking against number, Heidegger language, and the politics of calculation to be of particular interest, not least of all for the manner in which Eldon traces the severe shortcomings of Heidegger's political thought in the years following Being and Time to a symptomatically incomplete analysis of Aristotle's rhetoric in the seminars of the early 20s. And anyone who experiences the regressive territorial politics of the post-9/11 era, that is, all of us, should make a place on his or her bookshelf, or e-reader, or whatever, for 2009's Terror and Territory. Professor Eldon is also the editor of many collections, including most recently Reading Kant's Geography and Sloterdijk Now. Today's talk is drawn from Eldon's forthcoming The Birth of Territory, written in the course of a three-year Leverhulme Major Research Fellowship. This work on King Lear, to be presented today, comes from near the end of a startlingly wide-ranging investigation of the concept of territory spanning, and here I pick concepts and proper names almost at random from the detailed table of contents: Polis and Cora, Urbis and Imperium, Boethius and Isidore of Sevilla, the land politics of Beowulf, Aquinas and the Civitas, Occam and the politics of poverty, Dante's Commedia and Monarchia, the consolidation of the Reformation, and the geometry of the political. Today's paper is entitled The Geopolitics of King Lear, Territory, Land, Earth. Please welcome Stuart Eldon.
Thank you very much for that far too generous introduction. One that's difficult to follow. Let me try. I'm very grateful for the invitation to be here, to be the disciplinary outsider, in a sense, coming to talk today. And I want to talk about King Lear from that perspective of being somebody who works now in a geography department. Because King Lear, it seems to me, is a remarkable text about geographies, and in particular political geographies. It is, for example, in the folio edition, one of only two plays in Shakespeare's entire work that uses the word territory. The word territories is more common, appearing in six plays in 11 separate instances. And almost all of those instances are places where territories means effectively the same thing as lands. So Richard II banishes the Duke of Hereford, the future Henry IV, from his territories upon pain of life till twice five summers have enriched our fields. Banishment from territories also occurs in Henry VI, part two, is threatened in As You Like It, or Turn Thou More to Seek a Living in Our Territory, and it's threatened in Two Gentlemen of Verona. In other places, people are welcomed into the territories of a kingdom, and there is the constant threat of conquest or conflict, as in Coriolanus, for example. Now, those meanings, I think, can be put into political economic or political strategic senses of the way we might understand territory. But in Henry VI, part two, Lord Somerset reports on the situation in France, that all your interest in those territories is utterly bereft you, all is lost. Now, that might appear to be another instance of territories in a sense of lands, or as a battlefield fought over or surrendered, but the relation of interest shows that it's not simply property or a strategic sense, but the political control of and strategic sense or stake in those places. And that's the same phrasing that we use or we find in King Lear. Lear is discussing the plans for the inheritance of the kingdom between his three daughters. The first thing that Lear says is that Gloucester should attend the lords of France and Burgundy, suitors for his youngest daughter's hand. He then begins, "Meantime, we shall express our darker purpose. Give me the map there. Know we have divided in three our kingdom, and 'tis our fast intent to shake all cares and business from our age, conferring them on younger strengths, while we unburdened crawl toward death. Our son of Cornwall, and you, our no less loving son of Albany, we have this hour a constant will to publish, our daughter's several dowers, that future strife may be prevented now. The princes France and Burgundy, great rivals in our youngest daughter's love, long in our court have made that amorous sojourn, and here are to be answered. Tell me, my daughters, since now we shall divest us both of rule, interest of territory, cares of state, which of you shall we say doth love us most, that we our largest bounty may extend where nature doth with merit challenge?" At least that's how it appears in the composite text as is usually used of King Lear, which builds on the later folio, The Tragedy of King Lear from 1623, but usually incorporates material that was originally in the earlier quarto, The History of King Lear, which does not appear in the folio. There are also several, though fewer, lines added to the folio, including in this passage the parenthetical remark concerning territory. But the differences between the two texts has given rise to the contention that there are actually two King Lears, with the 1623 representing Shakespeare's revisions. So let me show you the text of each of these editions for this speech. The folio certainly appears a more polished text. Several differences in the first few lines. The diffuse darker purposes becomes the particular and comparative darker purpose. There is the telling replacement of our state with from our age, presumably because of amplifications to come, and that of years already implied by younger with strengths, indicating force and political power. It's difficult to see how anyone could claim that the quarto is simply a corrupt text. In both texts, Lear proclaims that the division has already been made and that the map he asks for presumably shows this division. The folio has lines that indicate the indication of Lear's wish to live out his remaining time free of concerns, ones that more clearly indicate the relations to Cornwall and Albany and the establishment of the plural dowers. They also include lines that suggest this attempt to head off future conflict. He wants to hand over his burdens, cares and business, as he says, to a younger generation, to his sons-in-law and the daughters married to them, and the third as yet unmarried daughter. Goneril, of course, is married to the Duke of Albany, Regan to the Duke of Cornwall. And in the folio, at least, it appears in large part that Lear is aiming this redistribution at the men more directly than the daughters themselves. A few lines later, there is the explicit, although parenthetical, remark noting exactly what is at stake: rule, territory, state. And finally, in the last line of this passage, the meaning is subtly different. Instead of this being simply to do with merit, there is now a reference to the conflict between merit and nature, worth and familial ties. Now, this supposed test of filial obedience provokes strong reactions. The elder daughters, Goneril and Regan, both obsequiously profess their love of their father, the first declaring that her love is dearer than eyesight, space and liberty. The second seeks that Lear prize me at her worth, only she comes too short, the most precious square of sense possess. And the language of geometry, calculation, economy maps onto the geographies they seek, and they receive lands in return. Somewhat unusually, it appears that they receive their dowries sometime after their marriages. Goneril is rewarded by Lear in the following terms. Of these bounds, even from this line to this, with shadowy forests and with champagnes rich, with plenteous rivers and wide-skirted meads, we make thee lady. To thine and Albany's issues be this perpetual. And the speech compresses a division of land within a wider realm of bounds and lines. It sets out its characteristics and establishes a lineage for its inheritance. The way that Lear turns to Cordelia shows this too, describing her as to whose young love the vines of France and milk of Burgundy strive to be interest. Yet Cordelia refuses to play along, and her first response when asked to profess her love is, "Nothing, my lord," to which Lear replies, "Nothing will come of nothing." Now, nothing is, of course, the void, a spatial category, and one which most exercised the 17th century imagination. Cordelia goes on to state that she loves her father according to my bond, no more nor less. Now, Lear fails to realise that Cordelia has no wish to join her sisters in their cheap flattery, and she alone probably loves him most. But being honest, in this case, is no reward. Leah tells her that thy truth, then, be thy dower. And the repercussions of these events quickly lead to developments that can seem unconnected, especially concerning the king's madness. But King Lear, I want to suggest, is a play which is fundamentally structured by this division of land. Now, Lear's reaction to Cordelia is misjudged, as is his belief, love in response back to his older daughters. But Lear, I don't think, is a foolish king for making such a division in the first place. Harry Jaffers made an argument about this, which I think is convincing. Lear is struggling with the question of succession and the unity of the kingdom he has created. Albany and Cornwall were the extremities of the kingdom, Albany being the north and the old name for Scotland, Cornwall being an expanse much bigger than the modern British county, but a formerly separate kingdom including the southwest and much of Wales. At the time of writing the play, King James's son was Prince of Wales and Duke of Cornwall. So Lear has clearly decided what lands these couples should receive, because they are given their gifts immediately after the speeches of the first two daughters, but before Cordelia's. In other words, he hasn't had to hear all three speeches before he decides how he will make the distribution. Lear then is not really comparing the speeches in order to distribute the lands, but he's using this as a pretense to buy off the two dukes. Indeed, in the folio, his opening speech had expressly indicated an intention to do this, that future strife may be prevented now. So division into three does not necessarily mean that each share is equal, and Lear continues to suggest that this is open to question. He rewards Regan's speech with this ample third of our fair kingdom, no less in space, validity, and pleasure than that conferred on Goneril, but then immediately indicates to Cordelia that she could gain a third more opulent than your sisters. Cordelia throws the whole procedure off balance, and it is then that Lear acts rashly. So it's important to note that Lear's pronouncement of this test for division was initially intended only for ceremony. Lear's plans seem to be already known. The opening lines of the play, the Dukes of Kent and Gloucester are discussing this. Kent tells Gloucester that he had thought the king had preferred or affected the Duke of Albany than Cornwall, i.e. rather than Cornwall. Gloucester agrees this was the case in the past. It did always seem so to us, but now, in the division of the kingdom, it appears not which of the dukes he values most, for equalities are so weighed that curiosity in neither can make choice of either's moiety. Now, moiety means a share or a portion, and Kent and Gloucester seem to think there could be no complaint from either for their allotment. This further seems to indicate that the apportioning of lands to Cornwall and Albany is the key issue, rather than to the daughters who happen to be married to them. Thus, Lear gives Goneril and Albany some lands close to their existing ones, and the same to Regan and Cornwall, reserving the central portion for Cordelia. Cordelia, of course, is being courted by the Duke of Burgundy and the King of France. And it may be that the principal purpose of Lear's test is to decide who Cordelia gets to marry. If she genuinely loves her father more than anything, she will surely follow his wishes in that choice. And Jaffa then claims that Lear is being very strategic in terms of division. It was an action predestined by the very means required to bring unity to the kingdom. Lear, it appears, delayed the division as long as possible, but he could not put it off indefinitely, any more than he could put off indefinitely his own demise. So the intention that Jaffa suggests is that Lear has this purpose of living on as king with Cordelia, with Albany and Cornwall acting as his deputies in regions which he could not control without their loyalty anyway. In sum, Jaffa asks, does it seem that Lear was giving up anything that he could not in any case have kept to himself much longer? Yet in not going along with this plan, Cordelia receives nothing from Lear. So Kent's attempts to mediate are swiftly prevented, and Lear apportions Cordelia's share between the first two sisters. With my two daughters' dowers, digest the third. Now Kent at this point says, reserve thy state to Lear, which has been interpreted as the only place where Kent's response to Lear is to point to the political folly in what he's doing, rather than the one in terms of a more personal relation, the relationship to his two daughters, the more personal error. But being without a dowry immediately makes Cordelia a less attractive proposition for Burgundy. He pleads with Lear to give but that proportion which thou yourself proposed, and here I take Cordelia by the hand, Duchess of Burgundy. Lear refuses to change his mind, and so Burgundy responds to Cordelia, I am sorry then that you have so lost a father that you must lose a husband. The King of France appears not to be so concerned. He had earlier told Burgundy, she is herself a dowry, and now declares, thy dowerless daughter, king, thrown to my chance, is queen of us, of ours, and our fair France. Lear grants her to France, with lines that are as stinging in their rebuke, the dismissal applying to, as much to Cordelia as to France himself, and welcoming to Burgundy, who, unlike France, has shown him interested in bounty alone. Thou hast her, France, he says, let her be thine, for we have no such daughter, nor shall ever see that face of hers again. Therefore be gone, without our grace, our love, our benison. Come, noble Burgundy. So Cordelia leaves with France, only to return later in the play at the head of the invasion force. The use of the word land in the play, I think, is also worth attention. As Francis Baker has noted, in one sense, Lear is about nothing but land, yet at best it comes into focus and then disappears again. Other writers have pushed the case further. There's a literature on the relation between Shakespeare land politics and apartheid South Africa, for instance. Nicholas Visser, in that reading, has underscored that all of the principal male characters in the play, with one major exception, are named after places. Gloucester, Kent, Cornwall, Albany, Burgundy, France. The major exception, of course, is Lear, who is never called Britain, but of course surrenders his relation to land at the very beginning of the play. Now, there are three groupings of the use of the word land in the play. One of them concerns the subplot concerning Gloucester and the inheritance of his bastard son Edmund, or his legitimate son Edgar. Edgar and Edmund are, of course, the other exceptions to this point I'm making about the names and their relation to places, but they are yet to inherit, and the subplot is precisely about that point, that they do not yet have the lands, and this is the question that concerns their story. As Edmund says, legitimate Edgar, I must have your land, and let me, if not by birth, have lands by wit. As foolish as Lear is in failing for Edmund's trickery, Gloucester, also foolish here, declares that Edgar will not get away, not in this land shall he remain uncaught. He listens as Edmund falsely claims that Edgar has described him as thou unpossessing bastard, and then declares, hark, the Duke's trumpets, I know not why he comes. All ports are barred, the villain shall not scape. The Duke must grant me that. Besides his picture I will send far and near, that all the kingdom may have due note of him and of my land. Loyal and natural boy, I'll work the means to make thee capable. So the land politics is here, even when the word is not used. Unpossessing in unpossessing bastard means unable to inherit or own property. Gloucester now describes Edmund as his natural boy, and thus legitimate, and promises to find a way to make him capable, that is, able to inherit. Second use of the word land, the kind of structures around this use of the word land, concerns the fool's mocking of the king for giving away his possessions. Go back to that first scene where Cordelia responds, her response to Lear when he's asked to profess her love is nothing, my lord, to which Lear replies, nothing will come of nothing. Now in this dialogue with the fool, Lear suggests nothing can be made out of nothing, recalling that earlier reply. The fool responds by asking Kent, prithee tell him so much the rent of his land comes to. And Paul Kahn has noted here that Lear had hoped to give away his land to his daughters and to live off or with them. But what he receives from them is nothing, so that the rent coming back from the land doesn't actually get returned to him. The fool then asks Lear, who was the lord that counselled thee to give away thy land, and describes him as the sweet and bitter fool. Lear asks, if thou call me fool, boy, to which the fool replies, all thy other titles thou hast given away, that thou was born with. And that last exchange isn't in the folio either. And this is the point where the fool then talks of the egg with the middle removed to show the two crowns that remain, the middle, perhaps, that Lear had planned for Cordelia and then swiftly gave away to her sisters. Third instance of uses of the word land in the play pertains only to the quarto. In that version of the text, the King of France and Cordelia invade Britain, and Shakespeare exploits two senses of the word land. On the one hand, it applies to Britain itself. So France spreads his banners in our noiseless land. France invades our land. But on the other hand, it implies the means of invasion itself. The army of France is landed. So the invasion lands on the land it seeks to control. And the invasion is a crucial point in both of the two texts, the folio and the quarto, but for different reasons. The folio is much more ambiguous than the quarto because it does not explicitly state who is making the invasion, though it is clearly led in both instances by Cordelia. The invasion appears to be a response to the ill use of Lear by his elder daughters, but the time span means the invasion must have been planned before any news would have reached France. So was it then an invasion to take Cordelia's share by force? Cordelia herself claims the invasion was only in her father's interest, again that term of interest, that France had supported her and that it was concerned not with any failure to profit herself, so that it's to support her father rather than to take back what she was dispossessed of in the opening scenes. So Cordelia says, "O dear father, it is thy business that I go about. Therefore, great France, my mourning and important tears hath pitied. No blown ambition doth our arms incite, but love, dear love, and our aged father's right. Soon may I hear and see him." Now, Kenneth Muir, I think, has convincingly argued that Shakespeare keeps this ambiguity in this edition of the play as a result of cunning rather than carelessness, because resolving the ambiguity could have been avoided only by slowing up the action. He notes that only 2 or 3 days have elapsed from the initial division of the kingdom in that opening scene, far too little for any invasion to have been planned for either reason, whether it's to support Cordelia in her claim for the dispossession or to support Lear against the two other daughters and their betrayal. In this regard, I think that the interpretation which suggests there are effectively two parallel timescales running in the play is more compelling. There is the day-to-day of dramatic action and the background events that shape the overall contours of the plot. This is W.W. Gregg's reading. Gregg, I think, is less convincing in saying that because of the time frame, the invasion preparations must have begun immediately France and Cordelia left Lear at the end of the opening scene. So even though the action of the invasion does not happen until the fourth act, various dukes receive letters alerting them to the news of this in the third. Gregg concludes, "There can be no doubt, therefore, that the French army had actually landed before Lear had any quarrel with his elder daughters." Now, in order to account for that, and to understand Cordelia's speech on her motives, Gregg concocts this complicated narrative where France falls out with Lear in an unscripted meeting, plans the invasion to avenge this wrong and the loss of Cordelia's portion, and then, learning of the ill treatment of Lear by her sisters, Cordelia is able to effect the invasion with a change in its purpose, which is then used to explain why France returns home, leaving Cordelia as the head of the invasion force. But if we follow what I do think is useful in Gregg's reading of this idea of the two parallel timescales, and we couple that with Muir's suggestion of a deliberate ambiguity on the part of Shakespeare, no such problems seem to me to arise. Cordelia, in truth, remains a much more sympathetic character if the more literal interpretation is followed. And indeed, in the reconciliation scene towards the end of the play, where Lear asks Cordelia, "Am I in France?" she replies, "In your own kingdom, sir," showing both obviously a respect for her father and that the kingdom is preserved rather than incorporated through the process of her invasion. The folio, though, seems much more carefully considered, as Shakespeare largely strips out the France and Britain conflicts in order to emphasise the civil dissent. There may have been important reasons for this. At the time of writing and presentation, the idea of a French invasion, even if one that is defeated, was politically obviously very suspect. Internal strife would have resonated much more effectively with Shakespeare's audience, and indeed was obviously the core of all of the history plays. There are some quite substantive changes between the two texts on this point. In Act 4, an entire scene from the quarto is missing from the folio version. In Act 5, Scene 2, the quarto's stage direction is for the powers of France to enter, which becomes drum and colours and soldiers in the folio without any use of the term France. Most of the references to France that I noted in the reading I've just offered are also lost. In one key scene, Kent informs on what is happening, but gives, I think, radically different speeches in the two versions of the play. So in the quarto, he says there is division, although as yet the face of it is covered with mutual cunning twixt Albany and Cornwall. But true it is, from France there comes a power into this scattered kingdom, who already, wise in our negligence, have secret feet in some of our best ports, and are to point to show their open banner. But in the folio, he declares this: there is division, though as yet the face of it is covered with mutual cunning, twixt Albany and Cornwall, who have, as who have not, that their great stars, throned and set high, servants who seem no less, which are to France the spies and speculations intelligent of our state. Now these, I think, give quite opposite stories. The first is the report of an invasion from France. The second is a report of civil dissension, of which France is aware. Muir speaks for the older textual position when he says that in general terms, the modern editor will, of course, restore these omitted lines, whether his text is based mainly on the quarto or on the folio. Indeed, he does just that in his own edition, the Arden II, gluing the two different speeches together as if they are part of a whole. Gary Taylor has taken issue with this. I think he somewhat overstates it in claiming that the quarto and the folio treat the nationality of Cordelia's army in consistently different ways, but he is, I think, on strong ground when he suggests any conflation of the two texts produces incoherence. I think that's a much more compelling point. Now, the story of Lear also appears in Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, but there the king says simply his intent is to divide the kingdom. And there are a range of other sources that Shakespeare may have used in the composition of his own version. In 1565, two politicians in the reign of Queen Elizabeth, Thomas Norton and Thomas Sackville, had published a play entitled Gorboduc, or Ferrex and Porrex. It had first been performed 3 years earlier, perhaps to an audience including the Queen. Norton apparently wrote the first three acts, Sackville the last two. Now, Franco Moretti has described this as the work that initiates English tragedy, and suggests that half a century later, Shakespeare rewrites Gorboduc and calls it King Lear. The story has some similarity. The king abdicates and divides his kingdom between two sons, Ferrex and Porrex. Porrex kills Ferrex and takes the kingdom, but is killed by his mother, Queen Verdina, in revenge. Then the people murder the king and queen in rebellion. The nobles put down the rebellion, but there is no legitimate heir, and the Duke of Albany seeks to control things himself. So Fergus, the mighty Duke of Albany, is now in arms and lodgeth in the field with 20,000 men. Hither he bends his speedy march and mines to invade the crown. Daily he gathereth strength and spreads abroad, that to his realm no certain heir remains, that Britain land is left without a guide, that he, the sceptre, seeks for nothing else but to preserve the people and the land, which now remain a ship without a stern. So the play ends with a sense of the disorder to come, with the plot synopsis declaring that the land for a long time remained almost desolate and miserably wasted. So this too is a play about the division of land, yet it's important to note this is not an uncommon issue, and actually Gorboduc is based on the story of Gorbodogo in Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, rather than his account of Lear. The influence, I think, is more compelling in terms of it as a literary text rather than the content. Yet like Gorboduc, Lear is also a text that comes from a particular context. The political resonances from Shakespeare's own time are important. Queen Elizabeth had died in March 1603, succeeded by James VI of Scotland as England's James I. King Lear has been dated between 1603 and 1606. Elizabeth's reign had been characterised by familial relations, among them her role as mother to the people. And it's been argued that the opening scene of Shakespeare's King Lear, the claim that the king had more affected the Duke of Albany than Cornwall, shows the kind of personalised politics of early 17th century England, the continuation from Elizabethan absolutism, as does the love test between the daughters moments later. James, of course, sees himself as the father of the kingdom, but is equally concerned with the unification of England and Scotland. Lear functions then both as his parallel and as his contrast. Martin Orkin has suggested that some of the passages cut from the folio edition were a result of censorship for too close a parallel with issues at the court of James, particularly the exchange between the fool and Lear on the giving away of land and titles, especially the reference a moment later to the question of monopoly. Orkin equally suggests that the challenge against enclosures and the dispossession from the land that this occasioned also frames the context of Shakespeare's play, with the disinherited Edgar in the guise of poor Tom as the key figure representing the landless in the play. Finally, I want to try and make some comments about the use of the word earth in the play. Apart from Gloucester's throwaway exclamation of heaven and earth when deceived by Edmund concerning Edgar, which actually only appears in the quarto, the first substantive instance of the word earth in the play appears when Lear threatens Goneril and Regan early in their betrayal. "Know you unnatural hags, I will have such revenge on you both that all the world shall... I will do such things, what they are yet I know not, but they shall be the terrors of the earth. It then appears, this word earth appears four more times at important moments in the play. First, the gentleman describes Lear's descent into madness in elemental terms. Contending with the fretful element, bids the winds blow the earth into the sea, or swell the curled water above the main, that things might change or cease. The second use of the word also relates to Lear's madness, when Edgar as poor Tom describes how the foul fiend hurts the poor creature of earth, thus tying himself to this element in opposition to the demons that are taunting him. But it's the third and the fourth instances of the word earth that I think are the most interesting, and they both concern Cordelia. She first declares her own good intentions, speaking of her search for Lear and his redemption, and calling for all blessed secrets, all you unpublished virtues of the earth, spring with my tears. Her antidote to Lear's madness, provoked by the terrors of the earth he had wished from her sisters, is her love, proven and redeemed at the end of the play. But it has a tragic ending. Cordelia dies, with Lear declaring that she's dead as earth. Now, much more could be said about Lear, which is, I think, one of Shakespeare's most geographically interesting plays. Henry Turner has suggested that despite the lack of explicit references to the staging, the sheer scope of its action, he says, with its wanderings, displacements, and geopolitical subplot, ensures the stage's spatial potential remains fully felt throughout. The economy of words, though, generally, and concerning space and geography specifically, is an important element in this work. The word earth appears just in these five or six instances, land limited times in the three in the quarto or two in the folio, closely linked senses. Territory appears but once and only in the folio. It seems significant that the word territory is not frequently found in Shakespeare's plays, even as late as the early 17th century. The word remained uncommon. It does not appear, for example, in the King James Bible, itself based on the earlier work of William Tyndale. And we forget the comparatively recent intrusion of the word territory into our conceptual vocabulary, thinking that the word and the concept can be found throughout history. Yet territorium is a very rare word in classical Latin. Until the late Middle Ages, it did not have the sense that we might think that it carries today. Emily Leider has noted that it may well be that the use of territory and other nouns in the opening speeches suggest a majesty of foreign influence later replaced by words of native origin. Land and earth can, of course, both be traced to Anglo-Saxon roots and feature strongly in the text of another classic work of English literature, Beowulf. Several things, though, in terms of Shakespeare's understanding of territory can nonetheless be gleaned from this instance of the word and the wider spatial and land politics of the play, or what I'm calling here the geopolitics, in the sense of the politics of the earth. Territory implies a range of political issues. It is controlled, fought over, distributed, gifted, bought, and sold. It is economically important, strategically crucial, and legally significant. While Shakespeare only uses the words territory and territories rarely, nonetheless, Shakespeare is, for me, a very interesting thinker of territory. A number of these plays lend themselves to such a reading. I think that would allow different aspects of the question of territory or the concept of territory to be examined. As I've tried to show today, we could look at the question of divided territories and their political economy through King Lear. We could look at corporeal territories, the body and its political geography, or political geography as a body through Coriolanus. Contested territories, obviously a recurrent theme in Shakespeare's works, for example, in Titus Andronicus or Richard III. We could look at conquered territories as, again, a recurrent theme, Henry V, Macbeth, or the question of succession, perhaps, the idea of succeeding to a territory that pre-exists. Colonial territories, of course, could be done through The Tempest, perhaps Pericles, Antony and Cleopatra. The administration of territory, perhaps, through Measure for Measure. And what it is, finally, to be outside of territory, historically, politically, conceptually, the question of banishment in, for example, Richard II. So how does Shakespeare's use of the word fit with the use of the word at the time that he's writing? It is, I've suggested, a relatively rare word, and its mature use, the modern sense that we have of the word territory, somewhat postdates the play. The debate with the word and the concept in the 17th century is actually not particularly in the British tradition. Hobbes and Locke are not especially crucial in the story of the emergence of the concept of territory. Jean Bodin comes somewhat early, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau already operates within an accepted context of territory. It's actually, I think, in Germany, the fractured geographies of the Holy Roman Empire, where the most important conceptual discussions in political theory of the question of territory at this time actually come. In Johannes Althusius, in the writings of Gottfried Leibniz, a much underestimated political theorist, it seems to me, but particularly in the work of Andreas Knicken. Knicken's work, which is almost an exact contemporary of King Lear, is the most important text, I think, of the 17th century for trying to understand and codify the question of territory and its relation to political rule. But Shakespeare is in other ways anachronic. He takes his early 17th century context and imposes it on the historical material that he's reading in this play. What we have in King Lear is effectively the dynastic and matrimonial geopolitics of the Middle Ages and the early modern period, reimposed on an earlier time. This is also true for the map that he calls for in that first scene. The idea that at King Lear time they would have had a map of that kind is clearly anachronistic. But while it would make sense in the context of Shakespeare's histories, it's somewhat out of place for the Britain of his time. So anachronic, could we think of a notion of the anatopic, of something being out of place? But if you look at the continent at the time that Shakespeare's writing, the European continent, it would have made more sense in terms of thinking about these kinds of geographies. England, in a sense, is unusual. It's actually something that would make more sense of what was happening at the time in Germany. And it's worth noting, I think, that while the histories are set in England, of the tragedies, only Lear is set in England, temporally rather than spatially distant from us. So is Lear a history, as it is in the quarto of 1608, or is it a tragedy, as it is in the folio of 1623? King Lear, of course, is dividing Britain into three, just as King James, at the time that it is written, is trying to unite it. And the play has been read as the collapse of the feudal social order and the birth of private property, but it has also been compellingly argued that rather the play is actually showing a collapse or a fall back into feudalism, where a unified state fragments into feuding aristocracy, where absolutism goes back into fractured power. Hobbes, of course, will explore such themes a few decades after Shakespeare's play. Yet for Hobbes, this is in terms of the fracturing of sovereignty. Shakespeare helps us, I think, to understand this in terms of the fracturing of political geography, of what I'm calling here the geopolitics of territory, land, and earth. And perhaps it's that fracturing that Lear has in mind when he threatens Goneril and Regan with the terrors of the earth. Thank you.